Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Edgy Ideas is proudly sponsored by the Eco Leadership Institute. We offer coach and leadership training courses, and we have a vibrant community of practice where international members join once a month for a webinar. Our focus is on co-creating the good society. To find out more, go to www.ecoleadershipinstitute.org, and to read my polemic blogs and essays, go to Simon Western at Substack. Thank you for listening. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, my special guest is Christopher Yates. Chris is Senior Vice President of Talent at Equinix, a Silicon Valley data center company. Chris has previously held senior people roles in world-leading companies. He was Chief Talent Officer at Ford Motor Company, General Manager of Learning and Development at Microsoft, Global Head of OD at HSBC Bank. He is a co-author with Pooja Sachdev of Rewire, a radical approach to tackling diversity and difference. But more importantly, Chris is a very thoughtful and visionary character. He's a soulful man, a lifelong Queen's Park Rangers fan, and I count him as a very good friend. Welcome, Chris, to Edge Ideas. How are you today?
I'm very good, Simon. Glad you got the QPR reference in. I was going to kind of just plug that right there.
Yeah. No, I needed to get that one. I know that's at the heart of who you are. Good. So today, Chris, we're thinking about organizations and their role in society. It's a big question. Where would you like to begin? What's your thoughts? How do organizations fit into society today?
Oh God, there's this quote that I didn't come up with it, but I've used it a few times in talks. So once upon a time, the biggest buildings in the village or the town or the city were the temples or the churches, and then increasingly they became the palaces. And so you knew who the most important people in the village or the town or the city were, because that's what the biggest building was, and the biggest building kind of tells you who has the power. And if you go into most of our cities around the world today, the temples and the palaces of the churches are kind of curiosity things where people walk around as tourists, but they're kind of things of the past. But the biggest buildings, the skyscrapers, the ones that dominate any city around the world when you fly in, are clearly not the palaces or the churches. They're the corporations. And so if we tell that tale of thousands of years of human history, I think that tells you something about who's most important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, power is shifted. And I remember when I first met you, and I was at HSBC Bank in Canary Wharf, and going up the lift to the top of that building, and you get the feeling of power. You go through the security gates, you go through the, you know, you kind of get the feeling that Canary Wharf is kind of where a locus of kind of power is in the world.
I was going to say, you reminded me of something. So in my time at HSBC, and it's interesting, I think yesterday was International Women's Day, and when I was at HSBC, I got invited to a talk at the House of Lords in the UK. And so I turn up, there's an invitation to celebration of International Women's Day in the UK Parliament. And there's a congregation of women on stage from the Congo. And so this is a useful plug for me to use your platform right now. And I can't say on a podcast how horrific the stories they told were. I mean, absolute barbarism in terms of torture, and all in the name of conflict minerals. So for those of you watching the podcast who don't know, conflict minerals are some of the minerals used to store power, the vibration, etc., on a lot of our mobile devices. Anyway, I got involved with this group of women refugees who had been tortured, their bodies brutalized in the most horrific ways. And I remember speaking to a journalist, a BBC journalist, because I got quite active and kind of, we ended up doing, you know, getting involved, a few of us from HSBC in a way. And so moved was I. I was kind of like, hey, I think I'm going to quit and just become an activist, because I was so shocked at the horror associated with conflict minerals. And the journalist pushed back. He said, you know what, you being aware of the issue and able to walk through the security every day and talk about this in the boardrooms of HSBC is more powerful. He said, he spent a lot of his lifetime, this particular journalist, researching the horror that went on in the Congo. He said, there's no way I can get past the four layers of security, past the boardroom of some of these banks, but you get to walk through every single day. So there's something about those of us who are watching from within the organizations and within the boardrooms that we have our moral conscience, an opportunity to play in how we influence. And it's interesting, I've talked about this, the role of people who may be watching the podcast sometimes, that if you associate the power that these organizations held, we are, and then go back, making my reference back to the times of priests and kings, we almost play this role of being advisors to the high priest, advisors to the king, because we have perspective or consciousness in some way of the impact of the organizations on the world. And it's kind of, to not to diminish often the role that many of you watching this podcast might have, that we get to cross those security lines, those security gates, and have conversations that seriously influence the thinking, even if you're in a, say, a leadership development role, a management development role, have the words, the choices of language that you use get to shape the people who influence some of the most powerful decisions today. And I don't think it's to be taken lightly, the opportunity to be an activist for good within the organization, because we get to cross those security lines. So little rant over, but you prompted that.
Yeah, no, and it's important. In fact, you know, I have some people saying, well, what you're doing working in the financial sector, what you're doing working in this sector or that sector, like, you know, you're an activist, Simon, you're a social activist. And I say, yeah, exactly. That's why I'm there. Like, you know, because, you know, that's where I can be active, you know. And I you know, I mean, one thing I'm interested in is, I remember I had a flashback to HSBC as well, and I remember you invited me to talk to some pretty senior leaders. I was quite new in my consulting role, and I was talking about kind of leadership, and one of the people in the room said, Simon, you've given us your background, and you used to be a psychiatric nurse and a nurse, and they said normally it's the private sector goes into the public sector to kind of help them kind of think about the future. What can you tell us about the private sector? And I looked around the room and I said to him, it's interesting, when I was in the mental hospital in the asylum in York, it was a totalitarian culture. It was a totalizing culture. There was nothing outside, you know, the walls around you, and you had to kind of, the culture was what Irving Goffman kind of called a totalized culture, where really, and this wasn't just for the patients, it was the staff as well. You were kind of in or you're out, and it was all encompassing. And I said, in quite a lot of the corporations I go into, I get kind of a shiver down my spine, because they have a totalizing impact on people. They're like, you meet super bright people, you meet people who are like really kind of sharp, and yet the cultures in some corporations really dampens people's individuality whilst claiming they want to kind of liberate people, but there's this kind of other impact. And I wonder what your experience is of that.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about the impact of institutionalization before within organizations. I think one of the places for me it comes to life is in something simple, power, the power to give feedback. Yeah. So let's say I'm an average human adult. I give feedback to my kids. I give feedback if someone gives me the wrong change in a shop. I give feedback if someone's rude to me at a bus stop, etc. So I live a life in society able to share my views as a citizen and within feedback, and say, and so the skill of giving feedback is something I practice every single day. Yeah, the humanity that I have in terms of my right to operate as a citizen in any society and to say that's not good, or to give praise. And yet within organizations, we have to teach people how to give feedback, because somehow when they've walked through the barrier of public into the organization, something happens where I am literally disabled in my ability to perform a human function that I have within my family, within my all of the other aspects of my human existence. So there's something dehumanizing of a natural skill, which organizations then say, hey, we need you to rediscover your ability to give feedback. Like, no, I'm perfectly able to give feedback. But when I've walked across that security barrier, something has changed because of the nature of the organizations that we need to spend billions of dollars retooling you to open your mouth to say, I don't feel comfortable about this, where you have the skill. That to me is one of the most beautiful examples of where we're investing in something that people need how to do. And what we're blind to is therefore the dehumanizing aspect of that conformity. Does that make sense?
That's really true. And, you know, people kind of give corporations a bad rap for things like this, but it's actually beyond that. You know, I work in hospitals, I work in the education sector, I've just been working in the international non-governmental sector. And it's the same there. Like, you know, it's the same, the same constrictions, and the organizations do the same thing. There's the same kind of cultures which stop that kind of openness. Yeah, which is a paradox.
There's something about the nature of power and how I feel my worth is in the organization. Who am I to give feedback? Who am I to have a perspective? Am I allowed to have a perspective? Am I allowed to give a viewpoint and coming in? And I'm reflecting that so many of our current organization models, we know, I love going back, are based on a military model. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which came from, you know, particularly the Navy, where if I'm at sea, there's like command is everything, because like the threat of mutiny, of allowing opinion, is dangerous. Potentially. Yeah. You know, we can't have a collectivist view of how we're going to run the ship or where we're going or how we deal with rations and stuff like that. So a culture that was adopted to make sure that we were successful on the voyage from A to B became almost the adopted culture for many organizations, I think, coming through the kind of Industrial Revolution, now kind of formalized into, well, this is the way things work. And I think, you know, I'm always trying to look at successful groups of humans operating outside of that. But somehow we always seem to default back to the same power dynamics.
Yeah, it's kind of hardwired into us, isn't it? I mean, I've been writing and thinking a lot about this as well, about kind of how much modernity is hardwired into us, how difficult it is. We find to think about organizations as ecosystems rather than as machines. There's this kind of hierarchy kind of hardwired into us from this kind of military kind of background, this kind of way of thinking. I think it's one of the greatest human challenges we face is how to understand our interconnectedness and the kind of our interdependencies. We talk about it, but actually doing it is quite a challenge, I think. You and I kind of we met and we kind of bonded. You know, I was a Bristol Rovers fan, you were a QPR fan, and we kind of like we shared stories of our youths, you know, working class boys. You walk into organizations and you have a kind of a different background to a lot of people, and you're black. What is that? What's that experience been like, and what is it like? Can you talk a bit about your own personal kind of engagement with organizations?
Oh gosh, it's an interesting one. I think I flipped at some point, okay? Because I think, first of all, there was kind of a... And I remember, so I was at American Express for a long time. And I think I remember getting coached at one point. I had this kind of double promotion moment. And I got told that I needed to buy a new costume. And I remember getting coached that I needed to go and invest in better costume because I was going to be appearing in the boardroom on a more regular basis. I had this like double promotion coming. And I went out and discovered like people pay thousands of dollars for suits. Before that, I was a thrift shop, you know, buying dead people, literally dead people suits. And it wasn't something that was important. And overnight, I got coaching that more of my income needed to be dedicated to the cloth that I wear for my words to be accepted. Right, which was really interesting. So and there was this kind of, to your point, masking. You needed to adopt the uniform. I needed to fit in. And I don't think lots of my terrorist background, if you like, came out. It was all about how to position oneself, how to fit in. I literally got coaching on how to rules. And like, it was invaluable. I think at some points that was almost survival techniques. Because I think for a lot of us coming through into organizations, it's like being invited into court and you don't know the rules of court. And you kind of turn up a little like from the provinces or a country bumpkin. And you're kind of like, I don't know how to use, which fork should I use? And, you know, how should I tie my tie? And there's so many rules that you don't get accepted. Your words don't hit unless you know how to do the dance. Mm-hmm. But at some point, it flipped. And I found that part of, and I kind of relaxed into it. I think there was a point where I was like, actually, I'm able to contribute here because of, you know, the words. Yeah. And I think my words and ideas at some point started to be more important than the cloth that I was wearing. And I think I did a conscious flip. And I'd say, for those of you who are Microsoft colleagues, I think probably one of the beauties of Microsoft was they were much more interested in what I had to say than what I was wearing, right?
Yeah,
and I remember, here's a flip. I remember going on stage at something in public in my first few weeks when I joined Microsoft and getting coached to say, what are you wearing that? Like, we don't turn up on stage dressed like that. Go to your hotel room and change into something more casual. Like, that ain't us in terms of, you know, me with my, I think I put a suit on or something. And I actually stepped more into the, I'm a QPR fan who comes from, you know, grew up, all my obsession was being on the terraces every Saturday and all that kind of stuff. And I grew into more of, actually, this is who I am. And that became more of my, like, I don't know, overt character within the organizations. And I think that gave me more actual confidence to come with more edgy ideas. coming back to your podcast piece coming in. And I think one of the interesting things is that when you look at so many people at these big name corporations and you listen to their personal stories, I would say 90% of the people weren't born with a silver spoon in their mouth. That most of the people are one generation. So many of the stories I hear of the colleagues I work with are, I was the first person in my family to ever go to a university. That's a very common story. And so I think there's a lot of people, and I'm thinking about this live with you, and maybe we all have that fear of, do we belong? And hence the conformity, you know, that I was describing that I went through. And you need this little nirvana moment to actually step into, it's okay to be who I am in spite of my background. There's this kind of charade that we're all having to do this dance to feel that we belong, that we're associated with this brand that maybe silences us at times a little bit.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it shocked me. I remember being in academia and I really didn't feel I belong. You know, I was like thrown out of school at 16, worked in a factory, and then you end up in academia and like, you know, people are treating you like a professor, and that sort of just feels weird, you know, sort of, you know, 1 minute you're a dumb one, next minute you're a clever one. But what interested me when I kind of did some writing and I started telling people my story, even today, it kind of really surprises me the power of a personal story and how it gives people permission to be themselves. That's the important bit. Like, it's not, my own story is not important, but just the fact I'm prepared to reveal that allows people to think about their own stories and their own past and their own relationships. And it just changes the dynamic very, very powerfully.
I agree. And this is always dangerous on these podcasts because you're very into political now. So I'm about to walk a tightrope, right? But I look at so many of our leaders. Leadership is big in the news right now, in politics, in organizations, and the links coming through. And with so many of our leaders, what creates great character? I remember learning, I've shared a few times that I've learned at West Point a couple of times in terms of what does good leadership look like. Yeah. So, you know, and one of the phrases they have is character before competence. And as we think about the character of leaders that we admire, is it because they came from, we achieve the success of the stories that they create? I created $1 billion. I did the big things. And that is a proxy for character. Whereas actually, you know, great leadership is in the moments of the small leadership. Those are the leaders those aren't the stories that the big leaders talk about to impress us. And there's something about the actual humanity of the small moments perhaps being what we should be focusing on, because those are the values-based moments. And, you know, the values aspect of who you are coming through is really the test of character that comes through. And what's interesting in the military was they actually teach about the small moments of leadership, not the big I am. Yeah. But when we talk about the press and we talk about a lot of the current world leaders, we focus on the big things and not the small moments.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a massive focus on, I wrote a Substack blog recently. It was based on Gil Scott-Heron's song, poem. I don't know if you remember it. The revolution will not be televised.
When my kids know all the words,
Yeah, it's fabulous. Like, you know, amazing kind of rap song. And it's just beautiful. And I was thinking about kind of the recent comment, like, you know, this is going to make great television, and the performativity, the performance of, like, you know, you must be your own personal brand. You must kind of perform well. And it's, you know, Instagram, so much about image. We're so much about image that actually this thing, this character, this depth of kind of relationship and character is covered over. I think, and that happens in organizations as well.
Yeah, I think it happens in some organizations. I've worked in a number of organizations now. I think it comes down, honestly, to the, if I use myself as a parallel, the confidence of the leader to be accepted for who they are.
If I need
to demonstrate my power to feel good about why I'm the one on stage talking about, you know, why we're going to go left or right, there's something about what's the source of your power, what's the source of your own inner confidence, the source of your own reason to justify leading others. And does that come from and I know you touch on the spirit, I think for some people that comes from a belief in a higher presence, a higher sense, to say I am called to from a values-based position? Is it because I've been through personal journeys myself? The small moments have taught me everything I know, and here I am today with the kind of servant leader, which is, you know, interestingly, much more often where the military goes. Or is it a kind of a lack of inner confidence which says I need to constantly prove my worth through achievement, and therefore kind of worship my achievement and be bowed down by my achievement. And I think it's a serious conversation for us to be having at a pivotal time about what does good leadership look like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's my life's work really in the last 20 years. And it's, I mean, one thing I'm struck by is there's often a kind of a fantasy or kind of a seduction into people being leaderless or flat organizations, self-organizing, which I'm big into. You know, eco leadership's kind of into the kind of that way of working, you know, being more adaptive, more agile. But there's a problem there, and people say things like, you know, from ego to eco. And I'm like, no, you got that wrong. You know, we can't all be Buddhist monks and kind of lose our egos completely. And if we did that, we wouldn't be very good in organizations. You know, what you need to do is kind of understand your ego and put your ego to work for society, put your ego to work for, and most of us are faulty human beings. Most of us are not perfect, you know. So, you know, I know a lot of leaders, and I, one or two really stand out for me, like, you know, quite difficult people, actually, you know, quite difficult people, but the depth in their heart were in the right place. They were trying to do good for humanity. They were trying to do good for the organization, and that carried them through, you know, they, you know, with all the kind of ups and downs of life and our challenges. If you kind of come from the right place and put your ego to work on behalf of the organization, on behalf of society, then that carries you quite a long way, I think.
I think there's something there. There's a, I want to throw a question back at you in a second on this. I remember, going to go back to my Microsoft times, I remember there was a moment coming into Microsoft. I sat down with my team at the time, and they do this, like they deal with like 360 practice. When you've been there about 90 days, and my team asked me, the question was, why are you not afraid? Which I thought was like an interesting question. Why are you not afraid? And the answer that came into my head, this is right back to the thing, was like, actually, I've stood in streets and, you know, railway stations and terraces where people have been running at me, trying to beat my head in. Yeah? And the answer I gave was something like, and I actually showed a clip from a British rail station of a full-scale riot. It was like oh, it was me at 17 years old, somewhere in the background in there. But there's something about having faced that adrenaline rush, got a bit of a buzz or something out of it. And it's kind of a weird courage. I'm not saying, not competing it to say, you know, those who've had real horror, but there's something about it actually having faced some kind of adversity or something where you've had that adrenaline rush or threat, and therefore you develop an ability to step into courage in some way, or you've had a moment which has allowed you to step into courage in some way, which says that someone speaking to me in a harsh tone within the organization is not going to intimidate me, and I'm going to retain my ability to think, or my ability to rise within to the moment, or not be bowed by aggressive behavior coming in. The question I was going to throw back to you, because I think this is linked. I know you'd done quite a bit of research before on social movements, and you were interested in the kind of 99% movement. I remember reading one of your papers around emergent leadership, which is to me fascinating, because in a time like this in the world, leaders are going to come from unexpected places. We are going to see, you know, someone that we don't know, some stranger is going to rise up out of the crowd inevitably in the next year and become a new folk hero for the people, a new leader, someone to challenge in some way. We don't know who this person is. They might be watching this podcast right now. What is it that in those moments, what causes that emergent leadership? Because I think if we know more about that, do we give more permission for more of us to step up day to day in whatever role we play in an organization and society to lead? What did you find?
I mean, what I found was, first thing I found was that a lot of these organizations, social movements, they don't like leadership, and they claim to be leaderless. And I found that to be a false truth, you know, that there's actually leaders everywhere. And you could actually, if you go and observe these organizations, you know, they might call it something else. They might call it facilitators or activists, you know, but they're leaders, you know, and they're leadership. What I found was that leadership was fluid, much more fluid than in kind of static kind of position power leadership. And people with character would step up, but they'd step up only because others made the space for them, allowed them, supported them. Like, you know, followership and leadership, that relationship is fluid, and it's really, really important. And we focus on the leader a lot, but not on the followers, you know. So, you know, that phrase, we get the leaders we deserve, is quite interesting at the moment. You know why is a certain leader kind of or certain movements, why are they attracting so many followers at the moment? You know, what does it say about society more broadly? If you take Greta Thunberg, she's interesting, you know. So she was this kid who's kind of had ADHD and a bit obsessional and a bit depressed, and she sat outside of school, you know, with no intention of being a world leader. And then kind of this followership around her kind of built and built and built. And she became kind of the world spokesperson for the environment, which was, you know, speaking to the world leaders at the UN very famously. And it wasn't just kind of her with a dominant personality commanding kind of a great charismatic kind of followership. She certainly had a strong personality, but she nailed it. She kind of nailed the message at that time, and young people kind of followed that. So I think it's very much about this relationship between kind of leaders and followers and some fluidity around that. So it moves between people. It doesn't just stay with one person. So with the white knight on the horse who comes in and saves the world, that's a nice story, but actually that's not how it happens. It happens quite differently.
So it has to actually be the conditions of the crowd. Is that what you're saying? And the tradition about the crowd sort of push, a hand comes from behind one person and says, in you go. And that's what happens. So it's not something we can control, but we wait for the sea to throw up what it throws up. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And, you know, some critical theorists, they kind of say it's never about the individual. I don't agree with that. I think individuals are important. They do have, you know, agency, and they do have special kind of qualities, you know. So Steve Jobs did, you know. So Martin Luther King's an interesting study. I studied him in my book, and people kind of think Martin Luther King, they talk about him being a leader. He led the civil rights movement, you know. Well, actually, there's amazing people who kind of every day they sat in cafes, they sat on buses, they took personal risks, they got locked up, you know. Tiny minor acts of leadership were happening all the time, and a social movement built and built. And then the elders put their hand on Martin Luther King and said, you're young, you're good looking, and you're a great orator. We need a spokesperson. And he was kind of selected on behalf of his qualities. And then, to be fair to him, he did become a great leader. He was very courageous, and he stepped into that role. But it was the other way around. It wasn't like Martin Luther King led the movement. It was the movement kind of led itself, elected him as a spokesperson, and then he stepped into that kind of role. So it's that kind of movement between leaders and kind of movements, I think, is interesting. And we don't give enough credit to that.
There's something that you're making me think about, which is between courage and the ability of the crowd to break you. Because looking at some of the leaders you've just talked about, eventually they were all broken by the crowd. Kind of, who are you to be stepping forward as a leader? Yeah. Which is almost to a degree what is played upon, what is used, what is manipulated by the media, etc. So who are you to be leader? Who chooses you? Which is very biblical in a way.
Yeah.
And the crowd comes back and challenges and says, who are you to be telling us what to do? There's lots of parallels, I think, within religious literature of the same thing. And there's that act of courage or bravery and almost what I would call the word honor in some way, which distinguishes at that moment. So I'm sensing this moment. It's almost like a hero's journey of you have to actually get over this hump of who are you challenge and show the bravery, the conviction, etc. There's something about, I'm wondering if that's something we really don't prepare people for, and that if we deserve, therefore, the leaders that we get, but we don't prepare people for that, be it as we work in organizations. And actually, maybe that is one of the most quintessential things we should be preparing people for. So as they chose Martin Luther King, there was an intentional saying, hey, at one point soon, we're all going to diss you. You know, as my kids would say, we're going to throw shade. And at that moment of shade throwing, we're going to help you think about that and prepare for that. And I wonder if that's an opportunity.
I think it's really important. I mean, I write that power corrupts, but projections corrupt more. And this idea of unconscious projections. So if you're a leader with a strong voice, a charismatic leader, man, woman, whatever, young Greta Thunberg, you're going to get a lot of projections. And when I'm working with leaders, I kind of coach them to think about, don't be seduced by the projections. When you're getting all the good projections, don't let your ego get so big that you start making really bad decisions. You know, you can see Bill Clinton in the White House when he kind of made those sexual kind of mistakes. My reading of that was that his ego was so kind of inflated by all the good projections he was getting, he thought he was untouchable. And then he kind of makes really bad decisions, you know. So don't be seduced by the projections, but also don't be destroyed by negative projections. So it's not all about you. So when you're a leader, some of it's about Chris Yates or Simon Western or Martin Luther King, and some of it's not. Some of it's just kind of you're an object to receive hurtful projections, love projections. You know, people want to project a lot of their own kind of family emotions, a lot of their kind of frustrations onto a leader, and you become like an object to receive those projections. And your job as a leader is to make sense of some of that, not to take it all personally, not either to be seduced by it or destroyed by it. and to kind of think about kind of, and we get picked because we're valances for projections. That's why leaders are there, kind of, they're necessary in a sense, so we can identify with them and project our kind of emotions upon them.
So it's actually then the only true leaders that we have are actually our martyrs to a degree. Because the only way that we think about true leadership over time is, well, they died for the cause because they hit that point and they emoliated to some degree. Like, they weren't able to move forward. The crowd came at them for all the things you just talked about, but they didn't retreat. They kind of died in role. And that death in role is the only way for your reputation as leader to be carried forward to a degree, or to step away from leadership. It's an interesting one that we almost tear down the people that we need to a degree.
There is, or some people reinvent themselves. You know, some people, I mean, I think really great leaders are people who can, I remember working with a leader and I wondered what was going to happen when she left her job. She became a national leader and she stepped down and I thought, you know, retirement's really going to hurt you. You're not going to be able to, but she reinvented herself as a local leader around kind of environmental issues and stuff, you know. So I think I think really great people don't get so attached to their leadership roles. If you become your leadership role, then you have to kind of die in role. If you're not so attached to it, and you know, it's part of you and not the whole of you, then I think you can could go and quietly do something else or reinvent yourself and pop up somewhere else. So I think this rhizomic thing happens as well, you know. So we kind of change our patterns and on our life's journey, we can kind of reconstruct ourselves.
So where do you think our next leadership is going to come from? Who's going to come to save us?
Well, you know, I critique Messiah leaders as well as study them. So, you know, so is it going to be a Messiah leader who's going to save us? I don't think so. I don't think there's going to be one. But there will be people who gain the projections of people who get really, really angry at what's happening. I mean, I do think there's you know, every action has a reaction. There's going to be an awakening, social movements, and leadership will, I think, come from the edges. It will be unexpected. There will be change. And I do believe that kind of a relationship, small acts of leadership, like in the civil rights movement, will start to gather pace and leadership will emerge from that. But I think it will start at the edges rather than from kind of some charismatic leader from the center. I think that's where the movement will start.
Going back to your opening point though, because I know one of the interesting things I've thought about, I know in some nations' laws, the organization legally operates with the almost as an individual. So it can be like Chris Yates versus Corporation ABC is the way legally it's set up. So the organization has the same kind of legal balance as an individual, even though the organization is kind of like way more powerful than Chris Yates. But therefore, at some points, could the organizations for their own long-term survival be in some point a savior? Could an organization be a messiah? Could an organization actually start to operate with a lot of the characters that we've talked about for the last 15 minutes so that an organization steps forward to lead away? I look, there are several organizations out there who've made ethical choices about how to compete, how to operate, how to think about things like, you know, shareholder return, and yet could have a more sort of destiny fulfilled to do that. Do you think that's possible for an organization to be a leader?
I think it's part of the transition, you know, in neoliberalism, the Milton Friedman ideas were that organizations, corporations were only there to make profit for their shareholders. That was it. They'd had no social responsibility, no part to play in the wider ecosystem. And I think that was challenged. There might be some retraction from that at this present moment, but I think organizations need to find their place in society. And I think that place will be one of leadership as well. You know, we have Patagonia, you have examples, you have environmentally friendly organizations. The church used to be that, you know, the church used to take moral leadership for good and for bad. It was a very patriarchal kind of church. But I've been working in the Catholic Church recently, and it's very interesting with Pope Francis' idea of synodality, like trying to get a much more grassroots synod in the church. So women and lay people are active now in the church where they weren't before, where it's just bishops in meetings. So I think organizations have to mature into this role you're talking about, really, about taking leadership. Because, you know, if you think about how society runs. It runs through organizations, you know, whether it's a not-for-profit, whether it's a corporate, whether it's a small family business, you know, this is how society kind of runs. Organizations have to really think about their place in society. I think it's absolutely vital. It's going to, you know, a lot of the work I'm doing at the moment is to build civil society. And part of that is to get organizations to play their part in civil society, to belong in society rather than kind of just act as closed systems.
Yeah, it's interesting. You reflected on this whole reaction almost globally to woke culture. The kind of anti-DEI, the wokeness that came out. I mean, I think about where that actually came from, the organizations. So to me, that was an interesting point that I look at the power. I'll pick Caterpillar, who I worked with for a particular part. The policies that the organization teaches by having a DEI department or something like that, to a degree, instills a belief system within the workers that corporation is the dominant place within a particular community. And therefore, the organization changes the society of that community because of the policies adopted by the organization. And so you had this thing where the so-called woke culture was actually pushed by organizations into society. And there's the backlash of society, like, who are you to tell us what to do? And I'm mirroring the role of the organizations to push an agenda in the same way as we've talked about the breaking point of the individual, where the individual as a leader looks to do something. And then there's the backlash. Well, who are you to tell us what to do? Yeah, who are you to be doing this? And almost seeing that parallel in organizations right now of saying, well, who are you to be telling us what to do? And in that moment, do you retreat with, and apologize? Are you martyred? Or how do you prepare? This is a big question. How, in the same way that you prepare the leader for courage, for moral leadership, how do you prepare the organization to play that same moral leadership within society? Because if you get my parallel, that woke reaction is very similar to the individual coming through.
Yeah, and organizations have to mature. It's about getting the right people on the board. It's about doing the leadership development work inside the organization. It's about building the culture around some values rather than just around profit. You know, so it's all the things we talk about and work together on. You know, it's doing all those things and just keeping at it. And as you and I know, there's a lot of good people in organizations. You know, there's a lot of very good people who kind of work very hard and have some very good values. And it's about kind of enabling those voices to be heard and enabling that influence to kind of take over. And I do think that organizations stop belonging, that they kind of cut themselves off. They used to belong, you know, like Roundtree's and Cabra's, the Quakers organizations in Birmingham and places that they were very, very attached to civil society, the local politics, the kind of like the workers, create kind of new housing and things. And that got lost somewhere, and we have to rediscover it. You know, the importance of organizations, as our sort of moral and social fabric has to be kind of uplifted. And that's a work to do, I think.
I don't know what's challenging, but I think organizations are very involved in the shaping of society today. The lobbyists, organizations are very powerful. Organizations, many would say, run our governments. They are more powerful than our governments. I reflect, and this is particularly when I was in financial services and banking sector, some of the financial regulations that governments were trying to bring in, the economists, the lawyers, the futurists, the bankers, those internal to the organization were far more nimble and with far more foresight than any regulator would be. Same within the tech industry. The people within the organization are able to look far further out and be far more nimble, trained than any regulator is able to be. And so you have this age where governments, society, are almost unable genuinely to regulate, because the speed of government, the speed of any government, even a kind of, a dictatorial type government, will be outpaced every time by the organization. So there is actually, I would say, more community involvement by the organizations today with more power than a Roundtree's, than your traditional element. And if I look at, getting into things like, societal impacts of AI, there's a lot of conversations that there is effectively no regulation to a degree because of the inability of government to outstrip that. Yeah. And so that moral character has to come from within the organization, because there is no other fetter.
Yeah, no, you're right. They are more powerful. I think what the difference is this the what that power is used for. So is it used for self-interest and for profit, or is it used for understanding the wider ecosystems that actually we have to deal with climate change, actually we have to deal with social injustice as well. You know, we have a responsibility, we belong and have a responsibility and accountability, not just kind of driving our own agendas. I think that you know, that's a major shift we're working on, and some organizations are doing it better than others.
I think you're implying a conscience that may not always exist, because if I'm working in my lab and I find a breakthrough, I'm excited by the very nature of my science, of the possibility of, well, what next and what next and what next, without consideration, quite honestly, without that. Because to your point, that institutional, this is going right back to the beginning of our conversation, that institutionalization, which wipes out the inability to give feedback, which wipes out the societal context, is often absent. So the very nature of institutionalization leads to a series or a steps of actions totally unintended because of the pursuit of science, of discovery, of what next, or which doesn't have the societal context, because I've cut that off by walking through the security gates. I've detached from society. I've detached my very ability to even engage with my colleague in the same way to give feedback.
Yeah, and no, I think that's what I'm driving at. Like, that's where that detachment, we have to kind of reconnect. That attachment is very dangerous. Sometimes it's unconscious and naive, and other times it's power driven. It's because it, you know, there's a kind of profit motive behind it. So sometimes it's driven, and sometimes it's not. But you know, unless we can reconnect organizations to have a kind of social role, and then we get to a very dangerous place.
Yeah, that word evil, I'm not sure how, because there's a, I don't think I've met maybe a couple of people, but generally speaking, I've met very few people in organizations who I would say, hey, I'm coming into work every day to destroy the planet and to destroy society. People are coming in to do their particular tasks, do a good job, make some money, go back home to their families and do what's next. And maybe excited about the possibility of a scientific breakthrough, of writing a new code, of creating a new market, etc. So no one is doing inherent individual evil, but there's something of lacking that consciousness of multiple actions being to unintended consequences.
For sure, within organizations, but the lobbyists you talk about, they have an agenda. The lobbyists who go to the White House, who go to the Parliament, they have an agenda, and you know, and their agenda has for too long been following Milton Friedman's and the Chicago School's creed, which is only kind of a profit for shareholders. You know, that has been challenged now. I think there is questions around that. And people see that the power of the tech oligarchs, or kind of the companies, that there has to be kind of a reckoning somehow, readjustment. You know, society readjusts all the time, you know, new technologies, new changes. And I just think there has to be a readjustment. And internally, you know, people have to learn to give each other feedback. They have to kind of learn to rehumanize themselves and be accountable to each other in that way. Yeah, the relationship to corporations and organizations to wider society has to kind of be reimagined as well, I think.
I'm going to tap onto that word reimagined. Increasingly, I think over the last year, I've been thinking about, because I think one of the failures right now then is the ability to reimagine another way.
Yeah.
So when it was feudal times, no one could imagine neoliberalism as a concept. It would be inconceivable as a concept, yeah? But somehow we imagined our way from a feudal model to neoliberalisms that we have today. And I think this gets me back to imagination and the role of art. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the role of artists and the role of imagination and the ability to tap into, you know, what provokes us. And I think I talked to you about this before, that when I look at all great societal movement changes through the dawn of time, yeah, they're associated with an art movement. They're associated with a form of expression. And I feel art is one of the things targeted today as being irrelevant, you know, increasingly, you know. But I actually wonder if this is, I'm using the wrong language of saying a Renaissance moment, because the language itself is not a Renaissance, but it's whatever that missing word is, of a rebirth or an art movement that we need almost on the planet right now. That we need that arts movement to arise to help us imagine our way out of something else. Because I genuinely don't believe most people wake up, even the lobbyists, thinking, you know, I want to poison the rivers and the seas and everything else like that. But I think it's an inability of us as a collective to really imagine there is an opportunity because of our technological advances, the science, the knowledge that we now have, to imagine a different way of how we organize. And I wonder how we provoke the artists of the world to help us make that transition?
It's a great question. I'm giving a talk in Bristol in a couple of weeks, working with an artist, a brilliant artist at St. Mary Redcliffe Church. And we've commissioned a piece of artwork because it's really important in organizations. You know, I was the chief executive and president of an NGO, international NGO. And I took the board to a small island off, 2 kilometers by 1 kilometer island off the coast of Ireland. And it had one house on it, and it is a natural place. And we brought an artist with us, and that just changed the conversation. It allowed us to kind of reimagine our work. So I think you're absolutely right. Like, digging into the world of art is fundamental to kind of this work, because it's very hard to kind of conceptualize it in a cognitive kind of way. We have to kind of step outside the cognition and go into nature, go into art, and find ways. Chris, we've come to an end of the podcast. It's been fabulous talking to you. We could go on for a long time. I'm sure we'll re-engage again. The questions at the end of the podcast: ideas for how to live a good life and create a good society. You've spoken quite a bit, but any final thoughts?
So for me, it's obviously love the Rangers and never be disloyal as a start. You know, I think it's concentrating on the small things for me, the small moments in life, the neighbor, the stranger, the everyday courtesies of what it meant to live in small community. I think we build back the big world that we all want and hope for our children by the small, meaningful acts that we do every day. And so there is no act too small where kindness is not the answer.
Absolutely. That's a great piece of wisdom. Chris, thanks so much for giving your time. I know you're a very busy man, and I'll see you along the journey. Take care.
All right. Take care, mate. Cheers.
Bye-bye. The Eco Leadership Institute is running 3-day face-to-face event in a spiritual center near Barcelona. The theme is Soul at Work. We're going to create a small faith community and explore our spirituality and how we bring our souls to work. It should be a very beautiful event. Contact us at info@ecoleadershipinstitute.org or visit our website for more information.